This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to the stage here at Stamfords Mr. Simon Reeve and Mr. Paul Blizzard, everyone.
Thank you. Stop worrying about the water bottle.
Good heavens. Hello, everybody. Have you got nothing better to do? Thank you very much for coming. How many of you have seen Simon on screen? Pretty much everybody. How many of you have read his books?
Oh, come on.
That's a treat in store for later. We're going to get straight into it, which is to talk about why Simon makes the shows that he makes, but more importantly, why travel is so important, why travel on TV really works. So can we kind of do a bit of a voyage around you? About where
a voyage around me.
Yeah,
that's
well, it's a travel show.
What is suspect? Yeah. remember to turn phone off, Simon.
Yes. Don't forget to turn your phone off.
Yeah.
I want to find out when you started to develop a lust for travel and what travel meant to you in those early days. What the inspirations were.
Well, I can tell a little fanciful tale. They said to me, "Don't put it in my take it out a bit." Is that right? Okay, a bit more. Very unprofessional. Sorry about that. You're working with an amateur. I wasn't a enthusiastic mad traveler when I was younger. I don't come from a travel-y background. I wasn't interrailing even when I was a teenager, partly through lack of money, partly through lack of inspiration, partly just not being inspired by it. I had a tough teenage years, and I didn't really embrace the notion of the big wide world and get out there the way I wish I had. I started traveling through work. I started working through travel, I suppose you could say as well. But I didn't get on a plane until I had my first job. I'd barely been abroad before then. My first flight, I remember, was up to Newcastle. And I remember it very vividly because I was basically an adult and I hadn't been on a plane. I mean, it might sound a bit odd now, but people forget how this whole age of the world on the move is fairly recent, in fairness. Right. And when I was growing up in fairly grey, greyer than this, West London, you know, people didn't really go abroad. A couple of kids in my school went to Spain, and that was quite an event. Now, you know, I occasionally go to a school, give a talk, you ask, whether it's a public school, private school, state school, whatever, and you ask who's been abroad here. Almost every hand goes up in every part of this country. They have no idea. The young people today, Paul,
they've
got no idea how lucky they are. But and I always loved the idea of going on journeys of discovery and learning, I think. Mm. And if you compare with my gran, had polio when she was a kid, and she had calipers as an adult on her legs, so she couldn't really walk, but she had a sort of converted mobility car, and she would take my brother and I out on magical mystery tours, and she would take us, and we were allowed to say, "Grandma, go left, go down there, what's over there?" And she would take us to really places like Hounslow and Park Royal Industrial Estate.
Exotic, magical places, incredibly so,
you know. When you grow up in Acton, that's exotic, believe you me. So, careful. I can say it, you can't. So, I wasn't an enthusiastic traveller when I was a kid. I have to say, my desire and my love of travel has come later. It's come partly because I think travel is the most magnificent way of racking up incredible memories and incredible experiences. And I absolutely embrace it for that. I've got a gig that I love. I feel very blessed to do it. I don't take it for granted. I know that I'm fairly fortunate to be traveling the way I am.
I know that you came to doing the TV shows through travel writing. But let's say everybody here knows you from the TV shows. So let's talk about what the philosophy is behind them, insofar as there is one. What are you trying to get across? Because, well, you're there with a camera, in front of a camera. We're sitting watching you from our sofas in our living rooms, drawing room.
What's the point? Yeah.
What's the point? Because there's so much more of travel that is more than the visual, more than the sonic. It's about the smells, about the feet on the ground.
Yes, it's true. And you can't convey that,
and you can't
really.
Convey. No. So what is the point?
And you can't even hope to convey the full context of a place. Because
sure.
If you're somewhere really exotic, and I think that's something that really doesn't convey, then it's the full spectrum of sights and sounds and smells, everything that is assaulting you almost.
The food, the people, the sky.
Yeah, absolutely.
The sea,
and that can be quite overwhelming sometimes. Yeah. And obviously only a fraction of that's going to come across on the telly. What is the philosophy? Okay, I'm not going to claim it as quite as grand as that, but certainly the idea behind all of the programs I've done from the very beginning, or almost all of the programs I've done from the beginning, has been to blend travel with issues, I suppose.
Quite.
To accept that this is not a time when we can legitimately and justifiably spend your hard-earned money, which you pay for your license fee, on going on some entirely sunny jolly where I go and look at the nicest hotel and the nicest beach. I think that time has passed, certainly on the BBC. We haven't really been... The national broadcaster hasn't really been making programs like that for a while. But I think what we realize is that just as life is a journey, regions of the world, there are regions of the world you can travel through, you can tell tales about those places while having an adventure. The adventure can help to link them all together. You can get a rounded-ish picture of a country from the journey that you go on. So we make journeys where we try and put in the light and the shade. There isn't much of a philosophy beyond that. I suppose what the main thing we do and main thing we're thinking about is it interesting, and do we think the viewers of our programmes would like to watch it and should know about it? That's basically it.
Let's talk, because one of the first things I saw you doing was the Equator trip.
All right, a while ago.
Which is quite a while ago, I admit. Do many of you here remember seeing...
Came out in 2006, I think. Thanks for nodding, sir. Yeah.
Well done. Some of you were there. So let's talk a little bit about the tribulations of travel and about travel journalism, about travel TV, because that was a memorable trip for you,
definitely,
not least because you contracted malaria.
Yes, I did. Thank you for knowing that, yes.
I do remember that. So tell us, how did that change in any way your perspective on the dangers of travel, about you're pitching these ideas through screens of this is a lovely place to go, but there is a dark side, here's the light, here's the shade. But of course, we do forget in this sanitized world in which we live that you are putting yourself out of your normal experience, out of your normal comfort zone, both you as a presenter and us as travelers, about what to expect from that, about being aware of the impact we have on the environments we're visiting and the environment's impact on us.
Yeah, absolutely. And sanitized is a right word in many ways for the lives that we live here. I think it's very easy for us to forget on our cozy island. Can you hear me at the back, by the way? Oh, good. Thank you for nodding.
Thank you.
So it's very easy for us to forget, you know, how fortunate we are that fresh water comes out of the tap, quite frankly, and everything above and beyond that is an absolute blessing. I don't think I did actually start to worry about the safety aspects of the journeys even after I contracted and was rather ill as a result of malaria. And perhaps that would have been a sensible thing to consider, but... I think while I had the malaria, maybe it's a very blokey thing to do, you know, you worry about it while you've got it and then you sort of forget about it afterwards to a degree. I was really sick. I thought I was going to die. I was vomiting blood. I had a temperature, a shade off brain damage. It was deeply unpleasant. But I also knew that I'd been stupid and I hadn't taken the tablets quite as religiously as I should have done, or anything like it religiously as I should have done. So I didn't deserve it. But it wasn't an enormous surprise that I got it, given that I was travelling around the equator.
Quite.
What a pillock, frankly. Anyway, I was a tele presenter, European in a difficult part of Africa, and I was able to get treatment. Luckily for me, what it was a reminder of was the inherent, I suppose, risks of those environments. It didn't put me off them. It just made me a little bit, I suppose, more willing to stop, sit down before we go on trips and consider the risks and try and mitigate them as much as possible. Because I've been in much more dangerous places, or I've been in a lot of dangerous places since travelling around the equator. But no, you absolutely can't ignore the fact that malaria is a risk in the tropical parts of the world. But you can virtually eliminate those risks by being careful. I think the main thing, if I can rub one thing on, you know, I'm always quite wary of anything that sounds like warning people about the world, because the main thing along a long, long list of things, what I have learned from my journeys since I started traveling widely, is just how safe and welcoming planet Earth and its people really are. And, you know, growing up, and I think I'd taken in a real sense from everything, from the media, from friends, from culture, whatever, that there is danger that lurks beyond the channel, you know, and be wary of it. But it's not, it's just rubbish. It's a very safe world, and so I've tried to embrace it as much as I can.
It is quite... I mean, I've travelled hugely and in some weird and bonkers places, and you always find out, you know, you think you're going to a war zone, but people still live there, people still have lives, and they're warm, and they're friendly, yeah, and they actually care. It is...
Normality exists next to absolute madness.
Quite.
And... if you can bear with me, the best example that really just leaps screaming into my head when I see that. And we were at the back, and I know you were watching some clips from some daft things that I've done. And there was a bit in the clip where I was in Mogadishu on the front line of the conflict in Mogadishu just a couple of years ago. I don't know why I'm looking down. There's a picture of me, us down here. I don't know why I'm looking at that. But anyway, it was on the front line in Mogadishu, and it was pretty terrifying, frankly. It's bullets flying everywhere, snipers firing over our head, incoming rounds, outgoing rounds, et cetera, et cetera. And we were told we had to run and get back into our armored personnel carrier because a group of fighters were about to launch a rocket-propelled grenade attack on where we were. Just crazy stuff. And so we started legging it from the front line. And about 20 feet, I just remember this vivid picture, as there was all this gunfire going on, 20 feet from the front line, there was a bloke sitting very calmly having his hair cut by somebody who was getting water out from a soldier's helmet to do it. And it was just that thing of just... calm normality in utter crazy madness. And that is life on this planet, and right, it's life for all of us. Ups, downs, swings, roundabouts, blah, blah, blah. And that's really what we try and include. We didn't get the shot of this bloke having his hair cut. We were too busy leaping into the back of the armored personnel carrier. But nonetheless, it's in the brain.
Tell us about some of the joys then. I mean, you get to go to some places that very few of us are lucky enough to get to, and to see them from perspective that even when we do go there, we don't get to see it from. So what is it that keeps you fresh in this? What is it that makes you still joyous? The joy that we see and the interest and the connection, I suppose, is the word, that we see that you have with the places that you visit on screen. What keeps that alive? The question I really ask, I suppose, is how do you not get jaded once you've seen one beautiful sunset over a Caribbean beach or a fantastic sunrise?
It's not as good as the one I saw in the Congo. Yeah,
Well, there we go, exactly.
There's definitely a risk of that. I think... the needs of television require that you do have a degree of enthusiasm about
it.
So that we start with that. Then, as I say, I don't come from a travelling background. I absolutely don't take it for granted. And I feel very lucky that the teams that I work with, generally, they're the sort of people that you would be happy, I think, to pay your license fee to, because they give a damn. Yeah. They, again, don't take it for granted. They know that even when it's tough, it's still fascinating and memorable. So there is very, very rarely a time when any of us has said, I just can't face it. I can't take this any longer. Even when it's tough, it's still extraordinary. And we're still having an experience that we know is a privilege. I think... I've got a bit of natural enthusiasm for life and for new experiences. I think that probably helps a bit. I've got a very bad memory, which means I forget that there was another lovely sunset in the Congo. That probably assists. But you can go to the same place 1,000 times and have a radically different experience. And I think I've become quite focused on the small differences as well as the massive ones. Nothing is ever the same. And I do worry for people when they say, I've been to Brazil, I don't need to go back there. What do you mean you've been to Brazil? This is like the size of a continent. You can go there 100 times.
It's always going to be different.
And have completely different experience each one. So, I think those elements mean that I really don't feel jaded. And I would be a fool as well to sit here and say, I put up with it, Paul, but I'm quite happy to sit at home. This is my job. If I don't keep the enthusiasm levels up and stay unjaded, then I'm in trouble.
There's also the sense that you can't step into the same river twice. Every time you go back to a country, it is slightly different. It has moved on, and so have you.
It's slightly different. And there is that thing, obviously, in TV, where a telly presenter's been to one place, often they don't feel he or she can go back to the same place again. And also, because obviously I only get the crumbs from Michael Palin's table, I mean, I do all right, but so if somebody else has been there recently, then I'm not going to get that gig. It'll take a few years, so park that idea for a while. So there's all sorts of considerations. Yeah.
You mentioned tough times. What do tough times mean in your vernacular, in your language? What do you mean by that? There have been tough times. What's the toughest bit about being away from family?
Family rows, okay. And things like that. I think the next one that popped into the head, I won't talk about the family rows, but the next thing I would say is emotionally difficult experiences that are quite hard to process afterwards. And I suppose that's where you can get an element of not post-traumatic stress or anything, not like that, but you can struggle to deal with normality after experiencing something extraordinary and extreme. And when that's compounded by witnessing suffering, witnessing poverty, witnessing the fairly awful, sometimes pathetic lives that most of our brothers and sisters on this planet live, now that's probably my biggest challenge. I mean, I've cried myself to sleep a number of times on the journeys, and so do my colleagues, when we've encountered something that not just in that small frame of the camera is upsetting, sure, but as you said, the whole thing, yeah, the whole picture, the smell, the emotion, the absolute sense of it. You know, when you get a mother begging you to take her tiny baby to give it a better life, oh God, I well up just at the at the memory of it now. It's just a knife through the heart over and over again, and it's very, very, very hard to deal with. And we talk about it a lot. A little bit of whiskey helps now and again, an early night, and also can assist. You know, we discuss it and we try and process those emotions.
Quite. Can we give them a bit of a sneak preview on something? Can we talk about something that's coming up?
I'd love to.
Because you've just come back from the Caribbean.
See if we can cue this.
Well, we might have it. Do you want it now or do you want it at the end? Should we have the VT now?
I'd go for it. Well, it's up to you. I've done a new telly series.
Tell us, do you want to hear a sneak preview? Yes. World exclusive. Oh, exactly.
You,
good man.
Give me that money later.
Where have you just come back from? What have you been doing?
All right, so risk of driving everyone mad. All right, so it sounds like a great jolly. I grant you that. I've just filmed a series that's going to be out in a couple of months, and it's called Caribbean, and it's my jolly journey around the Caribbean. And I hold my hands up, all right? It was a good gig, I accept that. In my defense, it isn't just there's a lovely beach. Obviously, it's a bit of the shade as well. And the idea behind the series was that we travel around the myself and the team, not on my own, we travel around the Caribbean Sea, starting on what I endlessly call the exotic island of Hispaniola. I'm sure you know where the exotic island of Hispaniola is, the island that Haiti and the Dominican Republic share. So we go through Haiti, Dominican Republic, round through some of the rather lovely islands of the Caribbean, and then up the South American and Central American Caribbean coast. So through Venezuela, Colombia, into Nicaragua and Honduras, and then to finish in Jamaica. And obviously, forgive me for rolling on. Yeah, it's a little,
it's a tiny
area here on this giant map, but it's a million square miles. And obviously, no doubt at some point in this program, I say a region of extremes, because it is. So one day I'm diving on a pristine coral reef off Honduras, trying to help some scientists to capture parrotfish and take samples from them, helping them in a very Muppety way, I confess. But nonetheless, beautiful reef, beautiful thing to do. And then basically the next day, so I was telling you this about this earlier, wasn't I? Sorry.
No, it's good.
You have to hear it twice. So next day I was walking onto the gangway of a Honduran prison, which is about as extreme a place as I have ever been in the world. So it's a prison where there are no guards inside. The prisoners guard themselves nominally, and they're all on different wings, because if they're allowed to mingle, then they annihilate each other. And absolutely terrifying looking blokes who've skinned people and murdered scores and have got loads of tear tattoos down here indicating how many people they've killed. Terrifying stuff. And utterly surreal, because they had this incredible, it was just before Christmas, they had this incredible nativity scene that they'd made from recycled objects that they were incredibly proud of. And the boss of the gang was really keen to show me this. And the next day, somebody was coming around to judge their nativity scene compared to all the other nativity scenes in Honduran prisons. And the full spectrum of that madness is really impossible to convey. I feel quite exhausted just thinking about it. Anyway, there's a clip, I think, or the Trails. And maybe we can play it now.
I'm on a journey around the Caribbean Sea with its thousands of beautiful islands
and an incredible mainland coast home to millions of extraordinary people.
This is a vast area with a rich and brutal history.
Some of the most dangerous places on the planet. BBC
it's one of the most vibrant and exciting regions on Earth.
It's the Caribbean.
Pasty bloke.
They promised me
on this first leg of my journey, I travel east across the Caribbean Sea. From the island of Hispaniola to the American territory of Puerto Rico. In the Dominican Republic, I'm picked up by the officers battling drug pushers and cartels.
That is a block of cocaine.
I come face to face with the reality of living in America's backyard.
Quite peaceful and still down there. Big bomb. Apart from this massive bomb.
I cross one of the poorest countries in the world and get a warm welcome at a voodoo ceremony.
And this is a real treasure of Haiti.
That was a good Caribbean. Good gig.
Thank you. Anyone been to Haiti?
Oh, well done.
Well done. One hand, bravely put up. Two hands, one at the back there as well.
Anybody been to a Honduras gang jail? Neither's Michael Palin, which is why Simon has to. He gets that gig.
I'm sure Lord Palin would do that.
Well, dispel some myths for us. What did you find out about the Caribbean that most people don't know? What is it that we don't understand about the Caribbean?
Goodness. Well, I start with size, I think. You know, you think of it as just being jolly little islands where people live sunny lives. We're governed by cliches, I would say, and the stereotypes that are forced on us by endless ads and marketing and daft Hollywood movies. So, you know, I did a series on Australia, for example. Now, I've been around a bit and I read a little bit and so on. So, but still, my impression of Australia is governed by Kylie and Crocodile Dundee, frankly. You know, that's the output that we've consumed. You can't deny that. Caribbean is basically reggae, Bob Marley, and Lilt adverts. Bacardi as well, isn't it? And it's obviously so much more complicated, so much more interesting fundamentally than that. I think if there's one thing people took away from the programs I make or from telly generally that I'd really love it if they did, it would just be, oh, it's a bit more interesting than I thought it was. You know, I'd like to find out a little bit more about it as a result. You've got tens of millions of people living across a vast area connected by history, geography, climate, etc. There are wonderful connections and differences between all of them. And, you know, that's really what we try and explore. We just try and basically say it's more interesting than you probably think it is, you know?
Quite, exactly. I noticed, show people your flask, because while we're talking about impact of tourism, we have bottles of water here in plastic. Why are you carrying this?
Well, I'm a bit of a ponce, I suppose. This is solid, and I can fill it up from my tap. It's partly, this is what I was saying to you at the back when you were saying, why are you taking your flask out? And I said, well, I've fronted a little bit of a campaign about plastic pollution and plastic bottles and the plastic waste that we all churn out, and there's not a lot we can do about it, but there are small things. And, you know, I try and use plastic as little as possible where I can. And I fill up my sturdy bottle that is nicely cleanable under a hot tap as often as I can. And it doesn't have these nasty, I'm sure this company doesn't do it before I libel them, but, you know, there's chemicals in plastic that people shouldn't have in their bodies, quite frankly.
Right. So let's expand.
And that we shouldn't put into the sea.
We shouldn't put into
as
the sea.
Well.
And on if beaches, I can,
you know, you see it on the traveling around the Caribbean, but it's been a big feature of the journeys I've done recently. I travel around the Indian Ocean. You've got beaches covered in plastic rubbish churned out by the rest of the world that are filling up our oceans and our beaches. And I think it's probably there's not enough spoken about it in terms of how much is talked about it and the problem it is. It's probably one of our greatest, if not the greatest, environmental issue. Because people think, oh, we'll be able to fix it. No, we really won't. We're not going to be able to dig out the extraordinary quantities of rubbish we're burying, we're we're polluting our vast oceans with, that is at depths that we can't get even a robot down to, let alone somebody with a little shovel to dig it out. We have no comprehension about the scale of our oceans, but we also have no comprehension about the tens of millions of tons of plastic rubbish and other rubbish that we're pouring into our seas every year. And it's the sort of thing, the seas are common ground, they're hidden, nobody takes control or charge of them, and we are absolutely destroying them. We're killing life in our seas, and we're polluting our oceans, and it is going to cause a hell of a headache. No, it's not a hell of a headache, it's going to ruin life for our children and our grandchildren. I've got a three-year-old. I don't want him to grow up in the world that we're creating, frankly. Anyway, what am I doing? It's pathetic, but, you know, we have to keep banging home these messages.
So let me ask about tourism, because
you're very kind.
It is a big issue. And we're here at a travel show, and we have to realise that anywhere we travel, we have an impact on how we get there in terms of use of petrochemicals.
Some of us who travel a lot as well, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's been a rise in eco-tourism. There used to be the adage, leave nothing but footprints, take nothing but photos. What's your view on this now? How is the responsible traveller expected to travel?
Well, I feel a bit torn, frankly, because obviously, I'm a Ponzi telly presenter who can bang on as much as he likes about how we should all be travelling responsibly and sustainably and eco. But, you know, I also respect the fact that for my postman, for example, who goes to Mexico several times, he's very fortunate to be living at a time where an ordinary bloke like him, an ordinary bloke like me as well, can have this job. But he can have that experience and have that that privilege. I think there's a snobbery about mass tourism, for example, that I think is very risky. But yes, I do think it would be good if we could pull everybody towards the notion, the idea of responsible travel, of eco-travel, etc. Why? Well, it's better for the planet, obviously. It's better for you as an individual, because you probably quite like your children to grow up in a decent world. But also, it's just more interesting. It's better for you. You're going to have a more interesting adventure paid for with your hard-earned money, spending your money responsibly and intelligently, rather than just going on a package trip and sitting by a pool. What is the point in that? What is the point in spending money that you've bled for to go and do that with headphones on, of all things? Madness. Don't get it at all. So, you know, have an adventure. Do it responsibly. Yes, there are consequences for our journeys, particularly somebody like me who travels a lot. There are consequences for everything we do, frankly. We are, myself, you know, I have a footprint like a small a small village in the developing world. Yes, that is the reality. We should not ignore that. We should try and mitigate as much as we can. But I think we can also do a lot when we're on our journeys. And I really beg you to do that. For example, there are now around the world, as you know, there are national parks across Africa, across Asia, around our planet, in Europe as well, but focus on the tropics, for example. There are marine protected areas. I'm sure you've all heard of them. They're basically national parks in the sea. And for me, these national parks, these marine protected areas, these are rapidly becoming wildlife arcs. Right? These are our last chance of protecting some of our most iconic creatures. They are fencing African parks, not to keep creatures with big teeth inside, to keep us out, because we are annihilating life on this planet. It's happening on our watch. In the 10 years I've been traveling a lot, I've seen it get worse. You know, you go to the Great Barrier Reef now, for example. People there who protect the reef, who are working there, they say, honestly, it's not like it was 20 years ago, but it's better now that it will be in 20 years' time. But when you go on your holiday, don't sit by the pool for more than a day. You know, sign up for the guided trip. Go to the marine park. Go to the national park. Because when you go there, you're helping to keep those places going. Your money, your entrance fee, pays for the rangers. It pays for the petrol that goes in the patrol boats that keep out the fishermen or the poachers. Those gamekeepers, they would have been poachers before you turned up. You going there means they're protecting the wildlife there, not just for you, but for our kids, for our grandchildren, for the next generation, etc., etc. There's that great poster. I think it's from the First World War, and it's got the child sitting on daddy's lap and the child saying, "Daddy, what did you do in the war?" And that really does get me. I really worry what my son is going to say to us in the future.
Last question for me, and then we'll open it to you guys to think of a question. So as we're sitting on our sofas watching you telling us about these fantastic places, what is it that you truly hope that we do as a result of having seen you?
Well, watch, you know.
Yeah, obviously to watch. But to then to be inspired to go and to retrace your steps?
That would be asking a lot. But yeah, I would love you to. I would love people to. Almost all of the things I do on the telly shows can be done by people who've got a bit of time and with careful planning. Not all of them. I'm not suggesting you go to the Honduran prison or you go out with the SWAT team or you go to Mogadishu, quite frankly. But you could. And, you know, I met a crazy Japanese tourist in Mogadishu who admittedly wished he hadn't booked his trip there. But the world is open. It is possible to go to these places. I would just say, what would I hope you do? Goodness, I feel, you know, a bit pompous saying it. But just obviously travel responsibly. Read up before you go. Travel with your eyes open. Do things your parents wouldn't approve of. Do things your grandchildren wouldn't approve of. Don't eat in restaurants where they've got pictures of the food outside. Meet local people. Take buses. Get out of your comfort zone is the main thing. Take chances. Life is so short. And what's on offer here is not just brochures and lovely pictures. You know, it's incredible experiences. Take it, enjoy it, live it to the absolute maximum that you can.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Simon. Time for you to ask some questions. Please, sorry, yes.
Straight up at the front. He clapped loudly as well. He's got
it. It's okay. We're coming towards you with a microphone.
Gentlemen, he has been nodding all the way through. Bless you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. How big is the team that plans the trips and how many people are out on the road with you when you go? Obviously, you have all these amazing shots, aerial views, and shots of outside the car when it's driving along. How many people are with you and how many people plan it?
Fair enough. Could everyone hear that at the back? How many people go with me? Is it the giant team of old? Sadly, not. With a case of champagne along. No, we have essentially four people, including me, travel out. So we've got myself, we've got a producer-director, we've got an assistant producer who does sort of everybody's jobs, and then we've got a cameraman who does the toughest job of all, as my mum is constantly reminding me. You know, there's that Ginger Rogers quote about working with Fred Astaire. You know, she does everything he did but backwards in high heels. Yep. You know, the cameraman, he's got 14 kilograms on his shoulder. He's looking through tiny little viewfinder, and he's walking back. Well, I go on and on and on and on. Poor guys, Jonathan, Craig, two of the main guys I've worked with. They're incredible, and all credit to them. I think they're among the absolute best in the business because they can run through a shanty town with me and a SWAT team wearing flak jackets, and they can get a glorious panorama or landscape vista shot, you know, pretty as we would call it, of somewhere looking beautiful. We, in some of those pre-titles, we've taken some shots from Caribbean tourist boards to avoid having to pay the exorbitant fees required for helicopters, because we do try and spend your money fairly wisely. When there's a shot of me driving past in the car, that's basically Jonathan or Craig has jumped out and just put the camera on a tripod, and then we do an up and pass, as we call it. And I go on a walkie-talkie, "Are you ready yet?" And they go, "We're just changing lenses." "Oh, come on, come on." We have a very friendly banter, of course. And then we whiz past and we get the shot. But you know, one of the challenges on the programs I make is you can film. One of the joys of it is you can film anything because you can sort of incorporate anything in. And the challenge is you can film anything. So somebody's got to be there saying, "Guys, we've got to be at such and such a place to at such and such a time." And, you know, it's hard keeping a team of cats on the road sometimes. But, you know, four, basically. And I think you asked how long as well. Back at base. So just a couple, really. There's not a set team for the whole, for any single trip. So people will come on to work on it, and then they'll work on something else at the same time, etc. But we'll start working months and months beforehand, obviously. We don't have a script. Nobody goes out ahead generally to work out where to put the tripod and where the presenter bloke's going to walk across. We have to make it up as we go along. But we do obviously have a plan because otherwise we would be just burning this and that would be unacceptable. So months ahead and a small team. And obviously, you know, I don't just rock up at the last minute, but I accept I have got the best gig in the team in that I go in for the meetings, but it's somebody else who has to, oh goodness, who has to go and queue at the high commissions or the embassies to sort out the visas. What I feel so bad when that's when I have to go and spend a bit on bubbly for them to say thank you. That's getting tough now. Sorry, thanks for the question.
Question, the gentleman here.
Hi. Hello, sir.
Hi. Obviously, some of your trips, you come to huge landmass and areas. I wondered how long you, say, for example, spent doing the Tropic of Capricorn or the equator, obviously, sacred rivers. Did you do it in one trip, or was
thank
it
you for
in seconds?
This is my back catalogue, thank you.
And obviously, the Caribbean, how long did you spend, for example, you know, travelling around the Caribbean to get all that footage? And
well, it's slightly obscene in a sense that we attempt to whip through, you know, a million square miles in a short period of time. But we spent, I suppose it was about 3.5 weeks per programme. We don't do it in one go, partly because I quite like my son to know I still exist, and partly because it's actually cheaper that way, because to work out the entire trip in one block would be mad. Logistically, that's really pushing it, and we would need 10 people working on the logistics and you know, arrows and figures on maps, etc. I have done longer trips. I've worked on programs where we had to, on Tropic of Cancer, for example, when we crossed the Sahara and we went into parts of the planet that foreign folk hadn't been for a very long time. That was about a month and about 5 weeks, 5.5 weeks to do a trip. And, you know, it's a long, long, long journey. But what's really mad when you think about it, it's even 3.5 weeks to make 1 hour of television. It's a crazy equation, really. And we'll shoot 120 hours, sometimes 140 hours of footage on 5 different cameras of various sizes down to the little GoPros. And then they've got to compress it all down onto. Oh, seems to be quite a lot left on the cutting room floor. You know, that's a depressing bit of it. But so longish trips, but not crazy long.
Long enough. Lady here. Thank you.
Do you do all the writing yourself? And how do you sort of carry out the writing process? Do you sort of have a notebook and you just sit in your wherever you're staying that night and write notes? How does it work?
Well, I probably should have a notebook. Thank you for giving me that suggestion. That would be a slightly more professional way of doing it.
The assumption is that he writes what he's going to say before he says it, of course. Do you?
No, I don't. We don't write down what I'm saying before it pops out. We might discuss it. You know, obviously, you see what I've become fairly good at after a number of years doing this is switching into tele mode, because I know that TV is just you're just lifting seconds and minutes out. So I can be walking along having, right, should we talk about, what should we say about something about this? And then I can switch after a brief pause for an editing, I could just switch into, so here we are I'm on the exotic island of, you know, that whole, the way tele presenters talk. I don't make notes. I do write the scripts, the commentary for the programs, that, almost all of them that I make, but that is entirely a collaborative process, and it's based around the involvement of the team who I work with and their views and their opinions and the arguments and rows and debates, friendly almost always, that we have about what issues we think are the most important, how we should couch them. We argue about words and tiny nuances, but generally after the event, when we're sitting there, when we've created, a structure's been created in the edit that happens after the programs. But I don't make notes. I haven't written a book about the programs I make since this one here about Tropic of Capricorn, partly because the stuff I do goes out very soon after it's shot. It's broadcast very soon after it's shot. So a lot of telly, it's made, it sits on a shelf for a while. Somebody has plenty of time to write a book at their leisure, wearing their slippers, and then get it published. And basically you need about 6 months, correct me if I'm wrong, wise expert here, but I would say it's about 6 months from delivering a manuscript to a publisher's to the point where it's actually published. It's quite old-fashioned, annoyingly, and tricky as a result. I've written about 8 books over the years, but not really about the programs, because we'll finish the third program in the Caribbean series probably just after the first program is broadcast. That is not enough time to do a book. I tried with this, and I was writing literally while the car was bouncing along, and it was just impossible. I started doing it on a dictaphone. I thought I'd be able to dictate it while we were driving, and then I'd send the file to a bloke I found in the Philippines who'd transcribe it. And I was sitting there in the front of the car, and I went, as we bounce along the roads of Namibia. And the guys in the back obviously just cracked up. And I realized, I didn't get beyond the first sentence, and I realized this is never going to work. So then for a book, I would write notes, but not for the TV program.
We've got time for one last question. Who'd like to ask it? No, we're doing well. Can we stretch to the lady at the back? Is that possible?
I can tell you, I'm bloviating. This is my favorite word.
Bloviating?
This is what TV presenters do. This is our job. We are paid to bloviate.
Where does the word come from? I don't understand it.
I don't know. Craig,
great word.
Craig, the cameraman, made me look it up. He said, all right, sorry.
Please, madam. We can't really hear you.
Is it on tap the top or project to us all?
Are you out of range? I got two very short questions. Come forward and we'll repeat them.
Yeah, go, you,
on,
go
it's on. Oh, it is brain. On. It is on. There you go. We're nice and close. Oh, yeah. One question, well, two short questions. One, the water bottle thing.
Yeah.
I would never use a plastic bottle at home. I do when I travel. How do you manage when you're traveling? Do you have the water tablets? And the other one is, your very first job, how did you get into your job? Because I've got a son who wants your job.
Is he here?
No. Oh, a few. How old is he? He's at school. So I've got a few years, have I? Oh, he's 11.
He's 11.
I've got a little bit of time, hopefully, then. What do I do on the road? Particularly when I'm part of a team, you know, I can't impose my desires on them as much as I try. I do make sure they all wear seatbelts. That is my number one travel tip. And I am fascistic, frankly, about enforcing that because I've seen too many traffic accidents. You can get these fantastic now steel water bottles that have an inbuilt filter in them that you can fill from a stream, you can fill from your hotel tap, and they will take out everything from the water. I think they're safer, quite frankly, than buying some bottled water that's been sitting in 50 degree heat for about 3 years. They're magnificent. Drink safe systems, drinksafe-systems.co.uk, I think. If you look up travel tap, that's a type as well. There's loads of them. There's a steel metal bottle. The second one is my first job. I didn't go to university. I left school with virtually no qualifications, fairly hopeless background educationally. I got a job as a postboy on a newspaper, and that was my first job. So getting sorting the post at a newspaper. Most telepresenters, actually, there's some. They seem to be public school educated, or they were in the army. So there you go. Cough up lots of money, or send them out to join the forces.
On the water purification, can I just add one thing? Lifesaver water systems are genius. Absolutely brilliant. They're quite expensive, but I've used mine all over the world. It filters out every known virus, bug, bacteria, everything.
I think they're probably quite similar ones, I would dispute the quite expensive when compared to, you know, £1.50 a bottle for water. You know, you pay 25 quid, you get a steel bottle that can stand the rigors of travel. It's got a nice top on it that click. Yes, stop.
We have to end. Right. I want to ask you one last quick question before we're turfed off, and a one-word answer. Of all the places you've been to, is the one place that you are dying to get back to?
Did you say a one-word answer?
I know it's impossible for you,
all
but try.
Of them.
That's five
everywhere,
words already.
Everywhere. There's nowhere I wouldn't go back to.
Really?
Genuinely. All right, Brazil. Brazil, okay? What an incredible place.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll just look around here. Namibia. I'd love to go to Japan. Russia. They're taking the mic off. Yeah.
That's why we call a travel show. Ladies and gentlemen,
thank you for coming over. Thank you very much.
Simon Reeve. Thank you very much.
You.
Good man. Thank you.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.